You're listening to Medscape's In Discussion series on metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease, a podcast where thought leaders and clinical experts share their diverse insights and practical ideas for optimizing patient care. This series is hosted by Dr. Lisa Van Wagner, Associate Professor of Internal Medicine at UT Southwestern Medical Center and Director of Digestive and Liver Diseases Clinical Research and the Internal Medicine Clinical Scientist Training Program. Relevant disclosures can be found with the episode show notes on Medscape.com or the Medscape app. The topics and discussions are planned, produced, and reviewed independently of advertisers.
Well, hello. I am Dr. Lisa Van Wagner. I am an associate professor at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center here in Dallas. I am a hepatologist, and I want to welcome you to Medscape's In Discussion series on MASLD. Today, we are going to be discussing fatty liver on imaging and what on earth do you do next? And I'm here with my esteemed guest, Dr. Danielle Bradman, who's also a very close friend of mine. She is a professor of clinical medicine, and she is also the medical director of liver transplantation at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City. And we're so excited to have her and her perspective. So welcome to In Discussion, and we'll get started. Danielle, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Awesome. Well, let's just jump right in. This is something that I think, I mean, all of us see all the time, and I know that our listeners see very frequently as well, but it's that incidental fatty liver that's seen on imaging that was done for some other reason. So when you see a fatty liver on imaging, take us through, how do you approach that clinically? What's going through your mind in terms of next steps?
Yeah, I mean, this is something we see really commonly, and it's a very common reason why patients get referred to my clinic. When I see a patient with fatty liver, I start to think about the umbrella term of steatotic liver disease. And under that umbrella, I'm thinking about mainly metabolic syndrome associated steatotic liver disease or alcohol associated steatotic liver disease. In the background, I'm thinking, well, you know, could this be a zebra and one of the much less common causes of fatty liver disease? But in reality, most patients are going to fall in those big buckets. So when I see a patient, I really just start to examine, do they have any metabolic syndrome comorbidities to land them very neatly in the bucket of MASLD versus are they drinking significant amounts of alcohol, landing them in the bucket of alcohol-associated liver disease. These days, we also have to think about that kind of category that's in between of MET-ALD. Do they have some metabolic syndrome? Do they drink in non-heavy amounts? But in reality, it's taking a detailed history and looking for metabolic syndrome and alcohol use, because those are really the most common things that are going to be causing a person to have fat in their liver.
Thank you so much for that. I think that that point about the new terminology for an entity that I think we've recognized for a long time is this overlap between metabolic risk and alcohol in this MET-ALD category is really, really important. I guess the other question I would have for you is, how frequently are you seeing this? Is this common or is it uncommon? Has it gotten more common? What's the trend been?
So we know that, you know, MASLD or fatty liver disease is really one of the most common forms of chronic liver disease. And we've known this for a while, but it's really been growing in prevalence and in incidence. And it's really paralleled the increase in obesity and overweight. And in fact, you know, fatty liver really affects about a third of the entire world's population. Unfortunately, we are seeing more and more. Also, an after effect of the COVID pandemic was, you know, people gained weight, but also people started drinking more. So, you know, we are seeing these two liver diseases really rise in presence. Even though I'm a transplant hepatologist, I see a lot of patients who don't need a transplant and probably will never need one. And the vast majority of those patients that I'm seeing either for a one-time consultation or I'm going to follow long-term, I would say the vast majority actually have MASLD or the metabolic associated fatty liver disease.
I think one of the things that I was thinking about is that I feel like I see a lot of patients in my own clinical practice who say, oh, I've had fatty liver for 15 years, 20 years. And my doctor just said, it's fatty liver. Don't worry about it. Like, just lose weight. It's nothing to worry about. What is the risk of taking that sort of watch and wait, lose weight approach?
Yes. So I can't even tell you how many patients I've seen that come in and say the exact same thing. Well, it's just fatty liver. And that hurts me a little bit when I hear it's just fatty liver, because it's such an important liver disease. I think when it hurts the most is when a patient shows up decompensated with previously unrecognized cirrhosis, now signs of liver failure, and they need a transplant. So that's upsetting, really, because I think the patients and probably, you know, their doctors and primary care providers didn't recognize that, hey, this disease could really progress. And I will say maybe, you know, 30 years ago, we didn't recognize that risk of disease progression. So it's not necessarily the fault of the primary care providers. What I would say is that, you know, when I see a patient with fatty liver, one of the messages I try to give patients, particularly in the earlier stages of disease, is that this is a disease that you yourself can fix. You can cure this disease through dietary changes, increased physical activity, and weight management. But also, now we do have drugs to actually treat fatty liver disease that has progressed to the point of causing more long-term injury with liver fibrosis. So we do have ways to actually prevent people from developing cirrhosis, liver failure, and liver cancer, even though the cornerstone of management of fatty liver is and probably will always be lifestyle changes, weight management. We do now have ways to actually halt disease progression. So calling it just fatty liver is really kind of missing the potential implications and also missing an opportunity to reverse that disease and really have a favorable impact on the patient.
Such a good point. I think one thing that I know I struggle with when I'm talking to primary care providers and referring providers, it's like, well, first, we didn't have anything to really offer. And so we kept all these patients within our general medicine practices. And, you know, we'd refer them over to gastroenterology or hepatology. And they told them to lose weight. And so the patient came back and said, well, gee, I really didn't have anything to offer me. Is that still the case? Who needs to be referred? And how should we be thinking about that framework of risk stratification and linkage to care?
So agreed. What we used to do is, okay, we're doing the same exact thing that the primary care providers are doing. So what is our purpose? I would say even before we had pharmacotherapy to treat fatty liver, we played a really important role in staging of disease. Long ago, we would biopsy a lot of patients with fatty liver for staging purposes. Thankfully, we do not have to biopsy for staging for most patients anymore. We do FibroScan or MRI elastography, non-invasive imaging-based tests to assess liver fibrosis stage. And before the drugs became available, our goal was really identifying the patients with advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis, because those are the patients that we knew we had to keep in the practice, and we had to provide appropriate monitoring to make sure they weren't developing liver failure or liver cancer. We still play that important role in fibrosis assessment, but we're trying to catch the people who have stage 2 disease, so significant but not advanced fibrosis or advanced fibrosis, because those are the patients who are targets for treatment. In a primary care practice, you know, you may not have access to a FibroScan. And we know that there can be a lot of geographic differences in terms of the density of availability of FibroScans. You know, in New York City, they're on like every street corner. It's like a Starbucks. But other places that, you know, may not have the same density of physicians, let alone gastroenterologists or hepatologists, you may not have access to a FibroScan or even MRI elastography either. So the tool that PCPs have at their disposal is something very easy to use called the FIB-4. It is a calculation using age, AST, ALT, and platelets. So really readily available clinical data that does not cost a cent. It really just costs those few seconds of time that you have to take to either enter the numbers into an online calculator, or if you work within an electronic health record that has, you know, these smart phrases or these auto calculators, it can become very easy to calculate that score. The FIB-4 is not perfect, but it can be a really good starting point for our patients who are at risk for fatty liver. My advice would be any patient who has a metabolic syndrome comorbidity should probably have a FIB-4 assessed. Certainly, you know, the patients with diabetes are going to be at greatest risk of progressing on to advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis. So you really have to pay close attention to those patients. Now, if the patients have a FIB-4 score that is high risk, meaning greater than 2.67, those patients definitely need to be linked to specialty care for additional assessment to see do they actually have advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis. That being said, a lot of patients are going to land in the so-called gray zone, the indeterminate range, which is going to be between 1.3 and 2.67. Those patients do need second-order testing to determine do they actually have significant fibrosis or worse, or do they have early stage disease. I think if you don't have access to FibroScan as a primary care provider, those patients should also be referred to GI or hepatology for a fibrosis assessment. The one other test that could be sent as second-order testing is the ELF test, Enhanced Liver Fibrosis Score. And that's just a blood test that anyone can order, really. And then the patients in the lowest risk group, those are the patients who have a FIB-4 of less than 1.3 and don't have diabetes. Those patients can safely stay in primary care. All of this, you know, with the caveat of if your patients have significantly elevated liver enzymes. And everyone kind of uses a different threshold for that. I would say at least, you know, 2 times upper limit of normal or so. If those patients do have significant liver enzyme elevations, they should probably see GI and hepatology as well, really just to make sure that it's not something other than fatty liver, because so many of these patients will fit the phenotype of fatty liver. But if we never do a more detailed serologic evaluation, we will never find other liver diseases that may actually coexist in these patients. And then just one other plug is that every single one of these patients should be screened for hepatitis B and C, because we really would never want to miss that in a patient at risk.
Oh my gosh, there's so many amazing clinical pearls packed into that, Danielle. And I just wanted to flesh out a couple. Number one, I just wanted to highlight what you said. We're talking about fatty liver on imaging. And because this disease is so unbelievably prevalent, you can have hepatitis C and have MASLD. You can have autoimmune hepatitis and have MASLD. Both those things can be contributing. So it is so unbelievably important, like you said, especially in people with elevated liver chemistries, that they do have an appropriate serologic workup for other diseases. So I really, really love your point there. And then, you know, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, you know, with the fibrosis 4 score, thinking through what's in that, and one of them is age. Are there certain populations in which you have to be careful or be more thoughtful about what to do with the numbers?
That's absolutely right. So just to kind of talk about age. Age is a part of the FIB-4 score. Not surprisingly, the older you are, the higher your score will be, because it's in the numerator, basically this ratio. There are some data to suggest that patients who are older than 65, we should be using a different cutoff. So rather than using 1.3 as your rule out cutoff in our older patients, perhaps we should be using 2 as our cutoff. That being said, I do like to look at the whole picture, and also knowing older patients are more likely to have advanced fibrosis because they are more likely to have the disease for a longer period of time. Certainly, if they have a score of 2.67, I don't care what your age is, you need a fibrosis assessment like FibroScan. The other patient population that I worry about are, again, the patients with diabetes, really, because FIB-4 may not perform as well in this patient population. This is the highest risk population for this disease. So I feel less confident in the FIB-4's ability to rule out advanced fibrosis in patients with diabetes. So again, the sensitivity in diabetes may not be as good. And then the specificity in older patients may not be as good as well. That being said, if we're really looking at the application of the score on a population level, it's really probably the best thing that we have, because it doesn't cost anything and it's easy. And yes, we're going to miss some patients, but it will allow us to identify other patients.
Such a great point. And I also wanted to ask you just a couple more questions about that sort of that next step. You talked about this opportunity in some areas, I mean, probably even in New York City. I don't know about your clinics, but our clinics have like a 6-month wait time to get in for a referral. And so the question is, are there things that primary care can be doing, right, in that in that gray zone, like you talked about, 1.3 to 2.67, to do that second line screening test. And you mentioned FibroScan testing, but also this ELF score. And I just wondered if you could maybe talk a little bit more about what is the ELF score? How does somebody send it if they want to send that blood test? Is that the same as a FibroSure or a FibroTest? I know a lot of us are familiar with that from the hepatitis C era.
The ELF test has been around for a while in clinical trials in particular. It really is a simple blood test that is commercially available. This is a test where I will admit in practice, I see a lot of values of ELF that fall into this intermediate or indeterminate range, but very few that fall into the high risk range. I do think it's still a very good rule out test. If you have a value, certainly that's less than, 7.7, that's very reassuring. And I know that's a little bit different than what is reported on the ranges for Quest. That being said, I actually think that the Quest ranges of like 9.8 are probably okay, just based on my own kind of real world anecdotal experience of sending a patient for an ELF who's already had a fibro scan, where I do feel more confident about their fibrosis stage. But I think really just the point is this is a simple blood test that really doesn't take much effort to send. And I think if you don't have access to FibroScan or MRI elastography or GI or hepatology care, I think this is a very valuable test that probably can be used more in primary care. Though I think it would be interesting to see, even more real world data, since so much of the experience with ELF has been either in clinical trials or well-defined specialized database studies.
I know I've been using ELF quite frequently, especially in a lot of my telehealth patients or satellite patients who aren't coming into clinic to get a FibroScan test. I do find it very helpful. And just for our listeners, it's a proprietary blood test that is looking at cross markers of collagen basically that are circulating in the blood. So it's not a formula that we can plug in online, and it is a send out, but LabCorp also has it. So I have had patients who've gone to LabCorp, and so you can get it through LabCorp or Quest. What about FibroScan? If somebody's ordering a FibroScan, sending somebody for FibroScan evaluation, what are the things they need to tell the patient about that test?
The way I describe it to patients is that it's kind of like an ultrasound, except rather than take a picture of the liver, we're measuring the liver stiffness. The only preparation that is needed is at least 3 to 4 hours of fasting. If you do drink alcohol, I would recommend no alcohol within 24 hours of the scan. You can drink water, but nothing else, nothing like coffee, because that may influence the results. But really is that it's a pretty quick test. You go in, there's no needles. The tech or the nurse or whomever is doing the scan will take 10 measurements or so on the right side of the abdomen, basically sending the sound waves through the liver and measuring the speed at which those waves travel. And really the higher the velocity, the stiffer the liver, and that correlates with the degree of liver fibrosis. Things that may make it more difficult to get a valid scan, maybe if you have a higher BMI, particularly more subcutaneous fat, because the waves have to travel further to actually reach the liver. If there is a severe amount of fat in the liver, that can increase liver stiffness and may falsely overestimate the fibrosis stage. And then finally, if the ALT is over 100 or if there's significant liver inflammation, that may also increase the liver stiffness, which may also overestimate fibrosis stage. And I would argue that if the ALT is over 100, that's someone where you also want to be confident about the diagnosis and not just staging. But really the nice thing is that the results come back immediately. I do them in my own practice when I'm meeting a patient for the first time and hopefully they're fasting and I'm able to give them those results immediately. And, I would hope that if a patient is being sent for a fibro scan elsewhere, that may happen. But if not, the results should come back probably as quickly as, say, an ultrasound result.
The vital sign for the hepatologist, right? A fibro scan value.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Danielle, I want to thank you so much for all your knowledge and everything that you've shared with us today about incidental fatty liver and the pathways and how to think about referral. And I wondered if there is one message that you would like primary care doctors to take away from this episode, what would that thing be?
I would say most patients with fatty liver are probably sitting in your practice rather than my practice. And you do hold the tools to stage these patients, or at least to start to triage them. So, you know, the top three things I would say you should do, FIB4, 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 because you have to do that and you're going to find patients who are high risk. And when you find the high risk or even the indeterminate patients, either order second order testing if you have it available to you, ELF or FibroScan, or refer them over to hepatology and GI care.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brandman, for talking about incidental fatty liver with us today. I think a couple of big things that I just want everyone to remember and take home today is, number one, there's a differential diagnosis to hepatic steatosis, though the most common for sure are alcohol and MASLD. But when those liver chemistries are elevated, like Dr. Brandman said, greater than 100, but certainly elevated at all, please make sure to consider referral to hepatology or GI so that we can help rule out other causes of liver disease. Remember that fatty liver is not the end point. So the incidental steatosis is really the starting point and having a conversation with the patient. And next step is assessing that fibrosis risk using that FIB4, fibrosis 4 score, as a simple, accessible tool. Most patients are low risk and you can absolutely continue to manage them in your practice, but identifying that high risk group and linking them to care is really critical. And that second line testing, if you'd like to pursue that while they're waiting for referral, FibroScan or ELF testing are both approved tools that are in our practice guidance for helping to further risk stratify. So thank you so much for joining us today. This is Dr. Lisa Van Wagner for In Discussion.
Thanks for listening to Medscape's In Discussion Metabolic Dysfunction Associated Steatotic Liver Disease podcast series with our host, Dr. Lisa Van Wagner. Be sure to look for more In Discussion episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Check out medscape.com or the Medscape app for show notes, links, and more information on metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease.